Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Scientist, 20th October 2018. So we're slightly catching up here. This is episode one, so we're going to be reading the editorials first. And the first one, and the editor is Emily Wilson. Patents before... Patients before tech. We must ensure that data-driven medicine puts people first. Advances in technology has done wonders for keeping us alive and healthy. Think where we would be without the likes of MRI machines, heart monitors and ventilators. So it's heartening to see that Great Ormond Street Hospital in London is now experimenting with how the latest advantage in artificial intelligence, robots and face recognition might aid patient care. Unlike medical tech of old, the latest generation heavily relies on the use of data. And, as we are increasingly learning, data collected for one reason often ends up in being used for another. For example, people who signed up to the DNA ancestry services probably never expected their genetic data to be put to work solving murders. Now, thanks to the rapid pace of genetic technology, police are using it to do just that. Even most people would be happy to assist with such inquiries. The benefits of other reuses of data are thornier still. Last week, it was revealed that Amazon has patented the ability of its Alexa voice assistants to detect when you are ill, such as by listening out for coughs and sniffles, then offer to buy cough drops. In the same vein, it's easy to imagine that a face recognition system designed to identify hospital visitors could one day be redeployed to search for signs of depression. Although medical data is generally subject to strict safeguards, it's not that clear whether data that later becomes medically useful can be equally protective. After all, you never know what you might come in handy down the line. Good healthcare relies not just on the latest advances, but also on trust. In striving for innovation, medical practitioners must do their best to protect their patients, both now and for the future. Yeah, it is going to meet the... complexity of healthcare is quite complex. The joy of moon moons. Last week, New Scientist sent certain corners of the internet into rapturous light by publishing a story about potential of moons to have about moons. So I think I must have missed a New Scientist. This included the suggested name for such objects, moon moons. The response of the social media was immediate outpouring of glee. Something about the words, childlike simplicity, makes it a pleasure to say, and thousands of readers were quickly firing off their own reactions. As it happens, Moon Moon is the name of a five-year-old meme depicting a wolf looking stupid, which certainly helped the idea spread. Some astronomers are bemoaning the use of Moon Moon, suggesting it makes light of a serious field of study. But given the terms such as Super Earth, Tuino, and Cubano are all accepted part of the literature, Moon Moon doesn't seem a huge departure. Ultimately, it remains to be see whether the word sticks or gives way to more pro-faced alternatives such as Submoon, Second Order Moon, but to lose Moon Moon and the joy it brings would seem an astronomical shame. Moon Moon. You'd have to think about that. You'd have to sort of, it's like, well, essentially, our moon is, if we consider ourselves a moon of the sun wasn't to... They go nuclear fusion, our moon would be a moon moon, so you'd have a moon 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 moon. Okay. Okay, there's a picture here which unfortunately I can't really comment on, but it looks really, if it's real, it is real, but it's sort of, really, looks like computer generated. Apple hits back at anti-encryption law. I do know there's something happening in Australia. One of its tech giant, Apple, has strongly criticised the proposed Australian law that would force companies to provide access to encrypted data. Quote, criminals and terrorists may start their attacks by accessing just one person's smartphone, said Apple in a letter to the Australian government. In the face of these threats, this is no time to weaken encryption. The proposed bill's hearing is 19th October, but Australia is not the first to attempt to clamp down on encryption. Law enforcement agencies and politicians around the world have long been calling for such measures, claiming it's essential to fight crime and terrorism. I agree. But even then, Terra was going to be smart. The UK's Prime Minister, Theresa May, has repeatedly pressed for the need for a ban on encryption. Computer scientist says there is no way to create backdoors for law enforcement without making devices more vulnerable to hackers, such as those who break into systems and demand ransoms to restore them. Plan to add folic acid to UK flour. Blast. Government ministers are backing a plan to fortify flour with folic acid in the UK, according to The Guardian. So folic acid is really necessary for neuron development. I might actually do a molecular tour of folic acid. I'll do a few molecular tours back of the amino acids. But that's firmly in my head. The move is intended to help reduce birth defects that affect the brain and spine. A lack of folic acid leads to problems with the neural tube development, resulting in conditions such as spina bifida and anencephaly. I don't know what that means either. Big brain, small brain. Pregnant women who's trying to conceive are currently encouraged to take a daily supplement of 400 micrograms of folic acid. But many don't take supplements. Quote, many pregnancies are not planned, meaning many women will not have taken folic acid around the time of conception and very early in their pregnancy, says Claire Livingston, Royal College of Midwives. Flour is already fortified with vitamins and minerals in more than 80 countries, including the US, Canada and Australia. When fortification was introduced in Canada in the 1990s, a marked decrease in beef birth defects was seen. Again, yeah, it's just statistics is a correlation I'd be happy with. Concerned over hare deaths, and that's spelled H-A-R-E, which means barley bumping time, I think. Yeah, brown hares are turning up dead across the UK, leading to fears a highly infectious rabbit disease, myxomatosis, has jumped species. Myxomatosis, caused by myxomavirus, was introduced to rabbits in Australia and Europe in the 1950s to reduce their numbers. The disease tore through the population, killing 99% of rabbits in the UK. Numbers bounce back after the rabbits develop some resistance about the disease's prevalence. Now, the University of East Anglia in Suffolk and Norfolk Wildlife Trust are warning that a mutated form of the virus may be infecting hares. There have been reports before the disease seemingly to affect hares. Now, a large number of dead hares have been found over a short period of time in the UK. In one case, six in a single field. If the disease were able to hit hares as hard as it did rivets, the effects could be devastating. The UK has a population that are already thought to have declined by 80% in the past century. In Australia, the hot conditions meant that our rabbits didn't have fleas for some reason, so they went over to help it along. They injected the brought in rabbit fleas for them. Yes, to help it along, but that now is mosquitoes are the main problem in Australia. Time to adapt to for rabbits, obviously. Time to adapt to a warming world. Michael Lepage. Climate change is hitting faster than expected, says Michael Lepage. It's not enough to limit the further global warming. We must also be far to ensure we survive it. That's a message from the coalition of global figures, including UN head Ban Ki-moon and billionaire Bill Gates. Well, they know what they're talking about. They are part of the Global Commission on Adaptation launched this week, which says that the impact of global warming is being felt much sooner and more powerfully than expected to keep reducing global poverty and maintaining economic growth. It says societies must do much more, much faster to adapt. I don't know. It's the real problem is that the major polluters are China and America, and these people are not going to be devastated by global warming. It's and so the impact of global warming will kill the economy, but might kill the global warming, in my viewpoint. Let's see what they say. Adaption action is not only the right action, it's a smart thing. We need to make this more aggressively. The cost of adapting are less than the cost of business as usual. And the benefit as unusual. Okay. And the benefits may be many times larger, says Ban Ki-moon, who, with Gates, is one of the 28 commissioners leading the new initiatives. Climate adaptation is not just about special projects, says Kristalina Georgieva. I like that. Kristalina, CEO of the World Bank, and another of the commissioners. Commissioner. Everyone should think about the resilience of climate change when making decisions. from governments and businesses to the general public. For instance, when buying a home. Okay, well, hopefully all of us will buy a home. Quote, a very significant opportunity for adaptation comes from the mainstreaming resilience in the normal investment we make. Wow, oh, that's a banking term. It says Georgievia. That's her second name. It doesn't have to be more expensive investment. It has to be done with risk in mind. For example, she describes how some farmers in Bangladesh have switched to raising ducks instead of chickens. In a flood, chickens drown and ducks swim. Bangladesh has also succeeded in greatly reducing deaths from cyclones by improving warning systems and building shelters. In 1970, 500,000 people died from one such storm. In 2007, fewer than 500 perished in the cyclone. Adaptation, so that's a factor of 100. Adaptation is especially crucial for the poorest because they are hit the hardest. That's the point I was going to make. They do get hit the hardest. Climate change may plunge around 100 million people back into extreme poverty by 2030. That is, it's not the rich people who are hit by hurricanes, it's the people just on the edge. Urgency around adaptation cannot be overstated, said Patrick Verkuijen. IJ is a special letter in Dutch. CSO of the Global Centre of Adaptation Initiative. He will help run the new commission. It sounds as though this is a plan for a plan for a plan. All that's involved in the call for adaptation is still stress the need for emissions to limit and mitigate further warming. Quote, we are the last generation that can mitigate climate change effectively. We are the first generation that has to live with its consequences, says Georgievia. This leads to a very obvious conclusion. We might have to mitigate, adapt at the same time. Launching such a big adaptation initiative just a week after the major UN report to what it may take to limit warming 1.5 degrees may seem by some as an admission of defeat. But scientists have always made it clear that we need to adapt even if the warming is limited to 1.5 or 2 degrees by 2010. Based on current policies, we are heading for more than 3 degrees. 3 degrees is an absolute piece of crap. I mean, I think we're going to have it, but it's just devastating. You can see the effect. Okay, for quite some time there has been a sense that if we opt to adapt, that means accepting defeat in fighting against climate change, says Jovina. But the truth is that we are experiencing the consequences of changing climate. It's not defeat, it's reality that we face. This means giving equal priority to adaptation. Half the money of the World Bank lends for climate-related projects, $20.5 billion, in the past year, now goes to adaptation, she says. The commissioners also say we can combine adaptation with the effort to limit climate change. For instance, solar panels keep homes supplied with electricity if a disaster damages the power lines. While the commissioner plans a rosy picture of the benefits of adaptation, in reality there will be hard choices, such as whether to retreat from low-lying coastal areas or build flood defences. This will be true even for wealthy cities such as New York. Quote, some places like Lower Manhattan will clearly defend with walls and other structures, but will billions be spent to protect, say, Howard Beach, a low-lying neighbourhood of Queens? I don't think so, says Jeff Goddell, the author of The Water Will Come. That'll be a fun thing. I wonder what that book will be about, Water Will Come. Well, it's a fun book. Quote, in most places, retreat is inevitable, and it will be driven by simple economics. The hard truth is, adaptation to quickly rising seas is a luxury that few can afford. Just such a US thing, isn't it? And it's all China's pretty mountainous. I should know. Okay. Smacking linked to teenage violence. Claire Wilson. A global survey has found that teenagers get into more fights in countries where it's legal to spank children, prompting campaigners to renew calls for make corporal punishment illegal. Spanking children used to be commonplace in parenting, but a growing list of countries have banned it, including Sweden, Germany, and New Zealand. I'd say Australia would be a bit. The practice will soon become illegal in Scotland, where
there are calls for the same to happen throughout the UK. Supporters of smacking say that it can be necessary for discipline, but campaigners say it makes parents, child abuse more likely and promotes violence more generally. To see if childhood smacking might later affect teenage behaviour, Frank Elgar of McGill University in Montreal, Canada, and his colleagues analysed the survey of 88 countries. Oh, I really hate this. I really hate this. It's such a it's a good idea, but it's such a really difficult thing to get right. These countries were each classed in one of three ways. No smacking bans, full smacking bans. No smacking bans, or full smacking bans, or partial smacking bans, where smacking isn't allowed in the schools, but it's illegal for parents, as in currently in the UK. Now it's found that 13-year-olds from places with the full smacking bans were less likely to get in frequent fights than those from nations where it was allowed elsewhere. In boys who fought the most, the rates of frequent fighting were 8.5% where there was full smacking bans, and 12% where there was none. This suggests bans not only keep children safe from adults, but also from their peers, says Alan Ryan of UK's National Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Children, which had long campaigned for a ban on smacking at home. But Kayleigh Bruntz of the UK Royal Statistical Society says this makes the mistake of assuming that a correlation between two things means the causes and the symptoms. This is exactly what I said. Who are you? Katie Bunce. Katie Bunce, you're a friend of mine. But you notice how they put this later in the article after they've got the main point across, and then they say, so you question this person. For instance, teenagers who get into lots of fights might grow up to be tougher disciplinarians. Or perhaps smacking and teenage fighting are both affected by the third factor, such as broader social attitudes. For centuries, there has been a slow decline in violence across many aspects of society, according to an idea popularized by Steven Pinker of Harvard University. Any force in smacking and teenage fighting could be two manifestations of the trend without one directly causing the other. Quote, As a parent, I would not smack my children, so it is tempting to believe if they were exposed to it, they would become more aggressive, says Bunce. But you need to be wary of jumping down the correlation to causation. I think that's so obvious. I really feel that we are not educating our kids properly by explaining that to them. Another caveat to the latest finding is that there was just a small difference in the frequency of fighting between countries with full bans and partial bans. In boys, the rate were 8.5 to 10%, a gap too small to be found statistically meaningful by the analysis. But Ike says the evidence shows that smacking makes children more violent. Well, there you go. I'm going to get on my conclusion and I'm going to stick to it. And here's a quote. Being hit or spanked or slapped does affect how kids react in their own social relationship, he says. That's just, well, that's so typical of just, you know what, I think I've been slapped, I've been smacked by this article. Stem cells from placentas could help fix muscles. Now, placental is a different thing. Placenta is in the uterus, it's the implant, and it's basically, makes the embryo parasitic. So it's really interesting what stem cells in the placenta do. So the placenta basically establishes a changeover blood supply. It's basically a lung which breathes oxygen from the blood. This is how it gets nutrients and oxygen and puts out waste. It's a blood interface inside there, and it's like the size of a big steak when it comes out. Stem cells taken from placentas have healing properties that can help people recover from having their hip joint replaced. Okay. I don't know why that says. Placentas are normally thrown away after birth, chucked away, but now Israeli country Pluristem has taken discarded placentas and developed a batch of mesenchymal cells for them. Or stem cells from them. These cells have a potential to turn different kinds of tissue and release chemicals that promote healing. Mm-hmm. To see how the cells affect muscles repair, Tobias Winker of Charité Berlin University of Medicine in Germany and his colleagues tested two different doses of cells on 20 people having hip replacements. During the operation, surgeons have to cut into muscle tissues around the joint, which can leave people limping for several months, particularly if it isn't their first hip replacement. Well, I'd love to use them to explain that.
6 months after surgery, some people who got a dose of cells had stronger hip muscles than those of the placebo group, as measured by the exercise machine. Oh, gee, that's such a weak article. All the people in the experiment, even those in the placebo group, were limp-free by the time they were tested at 6 months. Probably because everyone was having their first hip surgery, says Winkler. The improvements seen in strength suggest the cells would reduce limping in people having a second or third replacement, where muscle starts off in worse condition. This is Winkler. So, let me read what they said before. Oh, if it isn't their first hip replacement, that now makes sense. I misread that. Dennis Mongu of University of Leeds, UK, says animal studies show stem cells are often killed by recipients' immune system when they are injected into the body, but it seems mesenchymal cells seem to release tiny packages of beneficial compounds before this happens. They are full of growth factors and other goodies. Claire Wilson. I think the placenta is interesting. I find it really weird, that article. High-tech chewing gum. We're at 21 minutes in. High-tech chewing gum will never lose its flavour. Chewing gum that zaps your tongue with electricity keeps the flavour going forever. A pain-free device called Unlimited Electric Gum. It uses the piezoelectric crystal where the materials produce electric charge when squeezed. When the gum, quote-unquote, is chewed, it produces some more current and tricks the tongue into experiencing taste. Currently produces a salty or bitter taste. But the hope is to extend that sense. I like a good old salty, bitter chewing gum. Nothing like it. But the hope is to extend that, since the other researchers are showing that by varying pattern strength of electric charge, it's possible to reduce all five basic tastes, which I'll go through, aren't they? The mouth recap. Bitter, salty, sour, sweet, umami. So it's all charge, really. The strength of the electric charge. Okay, I find it hard to believe. So I put a charge in a plate in my mouth, and how's it going to affect the acidity? Or I don't understand. So it's hoped to extend it, since other researchers have shown. Well, have they? I don't know. At an event in Japan early this year, 80 people tried the gum. Most everyone reported experiencing salty, bitter taste. Some said chewing it was a bit like chewing nabushi, a small dried infant sardines used in snacks and seasoning in Japan. Oh, I'm having a snack of baby sardines. The gum consists of piezoelectric elements and electrodes wrapped in thin plastic film. I just don't think you can swallow that one. It has a couple of centimetres wide. It's a couple of centimetres wide, like a standard stick of chewing gum. Unlike real chewing gum, the electric version will continue to simulate taste buds for as long as it's chewed. It won't break down to a sticky glob, but I hope you don't swallow it. Noosha Oba of the Minji University in Japan has colleagues created a device and demonstrated at the ACM Symposium on User Interface Software and Technology in Berlin, Germany this week. Now, this is the latest in a line of taste-related gadgets devised by researchers, include a digital lollipop people can lick to get different tastes, and a virtual lemonade that uses electrode to trick someone into thinking the water is actually fruit-flavoured drink. Uber, his team, and others add flavours to electric gum and want to eventually create a product people can buy. Flavour is so key to nutrient and behaviour, and I think they're playing with complete. I don't think they've really thought this one through. Okay, here's a picture of a meteorite. It's just a bizarre picture. Totally bizarre picture. It's a meteorite hitting a planet. And it's got a tail, but it's unlike a cometary tail, because it looks as though it's a rocket engine. It's just a really badly drawn picture. Okay, alien life could ride space rocks to travel the stars.
Life finds a way, perhaps even across the stars. It may really be possible for organisms to travel all over the galaxy by hitching a ride on fast-moving rocks in the phenomenon called galactic panspermia. Oh, God. In this way, just a few inhabited worlds could spread life throughout the Milky Way. Now, I actually think that you add this up if inhabitant worlds really were much more common, and worlds were much more common, this is could be... I think a lot of statistics... You can throw a lot of numbers in here. On October 27, astronomers passed the first interstellar object they've ever seen come through our solar system. I remember that one. It was a lozenge, something called Oumuamua, that was the first concrete proof of rocks can be tossed out of orbit from a distant stellar system to make intact to our solar system. I like the actual mixture. A rock needs concrete proof. I like that one. Of course, it's not enough for space rock to travel between stars in order to transfer life. It must be captured by the star's gravity and eventually smash into a planet. Well, I think we can actually do some research by, you know, going to an asteroid, putting some microbes in the middle of the asteroid, then coming back, you know, a few generations later. Now, Ian Ginsberg, Mansvi Lingam, and Avi Loeb of Harvard University have calculated how often banished rocks might be captured in a new stellar system, and how likely any life is stuck on the interstellar projectors will survive. Well, I can calculate, a two-roll could calculate that. Is it any good? It's like billiards, says Ginsberg. You hit the cue ball and out of course, and by chance for momentum, so it spreads life. And life spreads across the whole table, which is the galaxy. The team has found up to 100 million life-bearing objects with a radius of 20 kilometers, about half the size of Saturn, Moon, any of this, could have been captured in stellar systems around the Milky Way. I'm just not really happy with that calculation. Even about 1,000 Earth-sized objects could have been collared in this way, they say. Okay. Now, smaller objects are much more likely to make the journey between stars, but the smaller they get, the harder it is for microbes to take shelter in the punishing space environment in the interior of the rock. It's a very dangerous ride, but you can think of microbes as tiny astronauts sitting in a natural spacecraft, said Loeb. It would be actually be thrilled to be a microbe sitting on a rock that makes it way across the thing. Milky Way. Gee, I'm bored as a microbe, bored killing a whole race of things, affecting history, doing photosynthesis. I'm bored of doing all that now. I just want to travel across the Milky Way. Oh, I'm so excited. This is one of the life-laden rocks is captured into orbit around a new star. It can smash into a planet, dropping off its passengers, which is actually true because a lot of earthquakes. So the thing is that they would chill down to nothing. I can sort of imagine some of this working, because meteorites in space, when they come hit Earth, even though there's a big explosion, the meteorite themselves have frost and it's rather cold. Once a life laden, okay, many Mars rocks have been blown off the planet by impacts ending up on Earth. This has led some people to speculate the life on our planet could have come from Mars. Even if it's possible, it's unlikely that life on Earth began with interstellar microbes, says Loeb. However, Ed Turner at Princeton University, yes, as they do in a typical article, Claire Wilson, who's the author, may have overestimated the likelihood of these captured objects carrying life. And many of these objects would not be chipped from larger habitable planetary bodies, so if they have a life, they must have evolved there on its own. Quote, the only a tiny fraction of the objects that would be captured would plausibly carry life, he says. I think this, anyone can just come up with a calculation, and if it's enough, it ticks enough boxes, they get reported. I don't know why they bother. Many of these objects cannot be, okay. If that somehow were not the case, a lot of them carried life, then life is very common and you probably don't need panspermia anyway. Yeah, that is actually a rather subtle thing. That's what I was trying to say before. If life's very common for this to work, life's very common, so you don't... that's the exact point I was trying to make earlier on. I didn't say it too well. the numbers are incredibly low if you do for life on Earth compared to the rest of the solar system. You come down to an incredibly small fraction. But if life's on every planet and you knock it forward, you don't. It's just, that's exactly what I was thinking. Our spacefaring descendants may even be able to test this idea. If life in different places around the galaxy is varied and diverse, that would be an indication that rose independently on each other. However, if they're grouped of solar systems with similar life on the planets, this would mean the microbes really are traveling between the stars. Now that is a sensible point. That is a sensible point. That if we find life, say, in our solar system, evolved the same, well, if it was in our solar system and evolved, it would be interesting. So if we find life in our solar system and they're completely the same, it would mean it's either come from Earth or a different system or this series of ores. It's one of these and ores that gets you down a tree of logic. The tree of logic. Okay, early signs of animal life found. So it's more in general, they tend to find, that's what Chelsea White, they tend to find molecules. I think the last time they found, they found lipid fats in a something. So to only find the molecules, don't find the DNA, they find the molecules which are only made up. Let's read this. Sponges are probably one of the earliest animal groups to evolve. I would say so, but it has powered hard work, proved hard work to find exactly when a geological time they appear. Now, analysis of ancient rocks and soils has turned up traces of steroids. Okay, they're steroids, typically inflammation things, aren't they? Yeah, steroids made by early sponges that indicate they may have been populating in ancient sea for at least 120 million years earlier than we thought. So it's so the multicellular life began about 500 million years ago. Which is the timeline? If animals first appeared predominantly bacterially or microbial world, they would need to harness microbes to live symbiotic with them, which they do now. Corals have algae in them. Yeah, I don't quite understand that sense. It says, Gordon Love, the University of California, Riverdale. That's the way where scientists produce vast array of steroids with antibacterial properties that could let them harbor microbes without harm. Is that... Well, yeah, I think sponges today produce lots of steroids. The earliest sponges are among a class called demosponges, which produce steroids and can be preserved in rocks and characteristic sterane molecules. What's that molecule? There's a molecule I was going to look at before. It's totally gone from my head. Bloody hell. Love and his team went hunting for these molecular fossils in a rock and oil samples in Oman, Siberia, and India to date between 635 and 660 million years ago. Well, it's just whether, I don't know, it's curious, but whether other bacteria produces it. And so, as I said, it's 500 million years ago, multicellular life animals, so, they found plenty of sterane called 26-methylstigaspartame that, as far as we know, is only produced by demisponges. Okay, well, they've actually got linked themselves on a particular thing. In previous work, Love had found other possible sponge biomarkers called 24-isopropyl chlorostame, 24-epic, in the same rocks. But some modern algae make similar compounds, which is what I was going to say, that algae, you ought to find a compound which only sponges make. Love says the evidence of sponges and rocks is now clearer. I think that's actually good. But the finding hints at a big puzzle. Sponges have skeletons made of silken fibers called spiracles and gives structures to the holy bodies. We don't see fossil evidence of spiracles until 540 million years ago, which is getting closer to the age where we see these multicellular things. At the dawn of the Cambrian period, if the biomarkers here are genuine Simon Sonnenger's, then we've got a huge problem with the fossil record, I'd say, says Joel Bolton, the National Museum of Wales, UK. I think it's logically a clear step, but he's done a logically conservative step, but it's not sufficient logically. It could be that older spherules are out there, but we just haven't discovered them yet. And it's also that he's finding an oil, the spherules may not come through. But Bolting, but there's a whole lot of rocks at this age, surely you'd be able to pick it up. But Bolting says there are many people hunting for them, and they have yet to find any. So perhaps some other organisms making the compound 660 million years ago, having evolved the same ability independently of the sponges, that's what I would say. Although we know that today sponges produce more steroids than other complex life forms combined, they haven't found other living organisms that make specific molecules that Love team found. There's a chance they are, or once were, out there. Love says there is another possibility. The very first sponges may have lacked silicon spiracles and would have been preserved as microfossils. If so, this would explain why the molecular science of the sponges are present at 660 million years ago, even though there was no microfossil evidence. In other words, we could be looking for fossils that don't exist. I find that really interesting. Cosmic radio signal spotted close to Earth. Close to Earth is strange. A strange flash of radio waves detected from space was traced to the galaxy that lies relatively nearby. Mm-hmm. Fast radio bursts, FRBs, are blasts of radio waves that last only a few milliseconds yet contain as much energy as our sun puts out in decades. Well, from its source or hitting us. More than 50 have been spotted since they were first discovered in 2007, but we still don't know what causes them. Most detected bursts have been billions of light years away, making them hard to study. Well, they're so strong, actually, that's the inverse square law type of thing. But Ryan Shannon at Swinburne University in Technology in Australia and his colleague recently found one that occurred unusually close to Earth, dubbed the FRB 171020. It was spotted by the Australian Square Kilometre Array Pathfinder Telescope. Hey, it's up there. Yeah, I think I'm just getting it up. Elizabeth Mooney of Australia's National Science Institute, CSIRO, and her colleagues, including Shannon, have now determined the probability came from ESO, which is the galaxy number, 601-GO36, a galaxy that is 120 million light years from Earth. The galaxy is a chiral size and a similar star formation rate and oxygen abundance to the other galaxies which the FRB has been pinpointed. Oh, that's just really weird, because, I mean, we don't know much about it. I suppose it's something. Now, let's see. Which lies 2.4 billion light years away in the constant league. So we've pinpointed another one. Amazing that we could pinpoint a radio burst to a galaxy, and how you tell it's, oh, you read the redshift of it, I suppose. However, ESO 601-GO36 doesn't emit the same continuous stream of low-level emissions as the Aguru galaxy. That's why they can track it down. It's producing enough so they can work it out. Contradicting previous suggestions that emissions are required for the FRBs. No, I don't know. It's just saying that are exclusively arrived. But they may be required. Manny and her team are now focusing on the telescope on ESO 601-GO36 to confirm that it does produce FRBs. My God, well, I don't know. If they spot another, they'll be able to pinpoint which part of the galaxy it comes from. My God, that's incredible. Incredible to be able to see a galaxy that far away and see what part of the galaxy it comes from. That's just mind-blowing. So, how many thousand kilometres away is it? How many thousand? It's 120 million light years away. Swinburne, close. 120 million light years away, it's still, and it's 120,000 light years, 1,000. You could possibly, that's incredible resolution if you could pick that one up. Because that's one part in 1,000 angular part. So that's still, you know, that's a relatively large galaxy in the sky. That's, one part in 1,000, 360 degrees in a thing. You'd be struggling to be about 30 degree in the sky if you're lucky. It's sort of like, and to be, see that resolution is just mind blowing. We won't actually be able to solve the mystery of what causes these fast radio bursts, she says. Some people believe they are alien messages, but Honey says they're more likely to be products of astrophysical events like creation of neutron stars. I mean, some people say anything, don't they? You used to be able to do it. Okay. This is by Douglas Heaven. Futuristic hospital unit is launched. Oh my god, father. In the 5 steps from the door to the reception desk, my photo has been taken, my face saved in the system, and the ID number assigned. For the rest of my time at this new high-tech unit at the Great Ormond Street Hospital, the GOSH in London, I'm followed by an AI. Oh, God. Video screens that will be visible only to staff show my head in a red box, annotated with a score showing how confident the computer is that I am who I think I am, before you actually come across. Tracking systems like this are just one of the technologies being tested by GOSH Drive, Digital Research Informatics Virtual Environments Unit, which opens last week. The unit is a collaboration between UK's National Health Service, University College London, and several tech companies, including Microsoft, Samsung, UK chipmaker, although the unit is part of GOSH, it doesn't provide clinical care. Instead, it's a place where engineers can interact with patients, doctors, and nurses, role-playing crucial scenarios to find out what new tech can do to be on for its role. Thank goodness, the ethics of this is just mind-blowing. It's a digital stamp, it says Noel Hurley at ARM. Lets us experiment and play with and build the break things into a safe environment. ARM's chips power most of the world's smartphones, but is also involved in healthcare providing hardware for many medical devices. The company now wants to embedded AI in those devices so they make quick automated decisions. An AI chip. Oh god, that's incredible. Medical AI has made great strides to diagnose certain conditions such as cancer, eye disease, but ARM's more interested in smaller tasks by streamlining the simple actions that are performed in the hospital thousands of times a day, such as registering patients and tracking people's movement. It hopes to free up more staff time for patient care. Nightmare environment. Since GOSH is a children's hospital, there will be a focus on how tech can improve the care of young people. Again, this is just spooky, because children can't really acquiesce to what's going on, and also it's whether it's got to remember data, and there's that data uploaded to the cloud. I remember looking at that. It's the whole thing. It's consent and recording things about. Several products checks are on the way, including a blue whale with in the main rabbits, and rabbits hopping about the wards, visible only to those people with augmented reality apps. God. One product or project already up and running is Project Physio, which helps children with cystic fibrosis put up with their physiotherapy by making a physio device they have to squeeze into a game controller. And better you get at doing physio, the better you are at the game, says Neil Servers, a managing director of Drive. Hospital staff are also asking young patients what would most like a hospital. Most of them want robots, said. Two robots are now being developed that can tell stories inspired by nearby objects. Children are not limited to what they think tech can do. Oh dear. I'll finish this article and we'll upload it. Moons of moons are called moon moons. Stars are orbited by planets, which are orbited by moons. But what comes next? More moons, according to the new analysis. Moon of moons has no formal name.
perhaps because we have never spotted one, but both submoons and moonmoons have been suggested. Such an object would have to be close enough to its host moon to maintain it gravitationally bound to the moon instead of the larger planet, but not in so close the moon would rip it apart or pull it out of orbit. Juno Collimier of Carnegie Observatory. It's a classic three-body problem. Three bodies are unstable. Their orbits are unstable. Juno Collimier of Carnegie Observatories in California, Sean Raymond, University of Bordeaux, France, have calculated that four moons in our solar system could theoretically have sub-moons. The Earth's moon, Jupiter's moon, Callisto, Saturn's moons, and Titan's and Apis. The moons are all relatively large and far from the planets, so there's a small area in the orbit which the planet's gravity might not steal the moon away. But even if these moons could host a moon, it would be difficult to get one in the right place, says Regman. Well, it's difficult to be in the right place, and then perturbations would get them out of the right places, how perturbation-free they are. Something has to kick the rocket into orbit at the right speed that will go into orbit around the moon and not the planet or star. And if that moon moved over the course of its evolution, as our moon has, it's unlikely the submoon would stick around. That's exactly the sort of thing I was saying. Okay, because our moon's slowly drifting out due to tidal forces. There's also been speculation about whether a moon could orbit a distant moon that it may be the first ever spotted outside our solar system around a planet called Kepler 1625b. That extra moon, if it exists, is probably a gas giant orbiting an even larger gas giant. This system where you've got a giant planet, a Neptune-sized moon, and that kind is far away from the planet. Is a sort of the best case scenario of a moon, says Raymond, by Leah Crane. Okay, that's enough. I'll put this out to pasture.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.